This is HPR episode 2062 entitled, Now the Chips Are Definitely Down. It is hosted by Mr. X and is about 41 minutes long. The summary is, show about an interesting documentary I recently came across and new piece of hardware.
This episode of HPR is brought to you by anhonesthost.com. Get 15% discount on all shared hosting with the offer code HPR15. That's HPR15. Better web hosting that's honest and fair at anhonesthost.com.
Hello and welcome, Hacker Public Radio audience. Today I'm going to talk to you about a new piece of equipment that I bought recently, and also about a documentary which I thought was very thought-provoking, probably explains why I bought this piece of equipment in the first place. But before I get on to that, I'd like to thank the people at HPR for making this service possible. It's very easy to do, you just pick up a microphone and hit the record button and away you go. Actually, the hardest bit I find is filling in the show notes. It's a bit you can never really be bothered doing. At the end of the day, even if you just record something and don't do much with the show notes, that's fine. It's just getting something out there. If everyone was to contribute one thing a year, there'd be masses to go round. So why don't you pick up a microphone and give it a go? So, this is my 11th HPR podcast. I think I did one back in February 2016. This wasn't the one I was planning to do, but we were getting a bit short in shows, you may have noticed. So this episode's going to be a wee bit off the cuff. These days I don't have the same time I used to have, so it's really just mainly off the cuff. I don't really get a chance to write much any notes up and really think very carefully about what I'm going to say, so if I've got lots of ums and ahs and all sorts of things like that, I apologise. It's just getting the shows out that matters. So, anyway, the documentary I saw was called Now the Chips Are Down. That was the title, and it was a BBC Horizon documentary. So the BBC, I've got an iPlayer app thing that you can stream content, and the BBC select archive footage. There's an archive section where they select footage that they think the public will be particularly interested in, and this one was chosen. I think it was originally broadcasted in 1977, I think it was, something like that. I'm not sure. Anyway, in it they talk about the growth of the silicon chip industry and the implications it will have on society. They were saying that you may be aware that William Shockley invented the transistor. I don't know what the year was. So from what I gather, William Shockley and seven other people set up a business. I think it may have been called, again this is all from memory, National Semiconductors. And National Semiconductors, William Shockley was a very difficult person to work for, and in fact, at one point, some of us had a lot of controversy around him. I think I seem to remember hearing at some point that he had very strong views on. He was kind of suggesting that if you weren't clever enough or the right kind of person, then you should be sterilised so that Only the clever people will inherit the earth, so to speak. So obviously that was fairly controversial. But anyway, it was almost impossible to work with. And so much so that these seven people that worked with him one by one left and started up their own company. And each one of these companies was hugely successful. And this is how the basis of how Silicon Valley was came into existence. But the other fascinating thing about it was we were talking about how chips are made and such like, and they said in a very small number of years, the number of chips doubled and doubled and doubled again, so they became four transistors in a chip. So a transistor is just like a solid state device which can switch signals very fast. It's like a switch, or it can be used as an amplifier. Anyway, if you package enough of these transistors together, you can make microprocessors and all sorts of complex chips and such like. But anyway, they were saying that it went from 4 to 8 to 16, 32, and I think at that point they were up to 250,000 transistors on a chip, and that was I say back in 77. But the thing was that what happens is they take a photographic image of the circuit they want, and they shrink it down and put it onto a slice of silicon. And this slice of silicon is when you look at it, it's, I don't know. It looked to me like it was a meter in diameter, no, half a meter in diameter, something like that. There's, I don't know how many squares were on this slice of silicon, but each square was a chip, and so to get to that final process, it had to go through many, many stages. It was a very, very difficult process, and once they had the disk of silicon, they put it under onto a machine that would connect contacts to each chip and run a series of tests to see if the chip would end up being successful or not. And it was, I can't remember, it was like, I think it was, we could test two chips a second or something like that. And so as it was moving along, any time it failed, a wee red blob was printed onto the square of silicon to show that it had failed. So as it was going along, it was going chip 1, 2, 3, 4, and so as it was moving along, it was this sort of thing. It was like fail, 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 pass, fail, fail, pass, pass, fail, fail, fail. It was a huge proportion of fails, and so only they reckon about 25% were a success, and if it was 25%, then they thought that was a pretty good yield, you know, pretty good. I don't know what the current status is. before they actually made these chips, they had a vast piece of I don't know if it was like Melnix, a piece of material that they would check by hand with an eyeglass. But even though it was shrunken down dramatically, it was still a vast sheet. So it shows you the complexity and the difficulty of making these things back in 77. And so much so that they had extremely clean room conditions. You know, a single bit of dirt or something would just destroy the whole process. And there was cases where factories would start to produce nothing but fails. And for, you know, hour after hour, day after day, fail, 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 fail. And then the company would go bankrupt. So one way around that was to split the process into smaller chunks, so that only part of the process would fail and not the whole thing. But the whole thing was unbelievably elaborate and very difficult. And the thing is that most people today just take technology for granted. Even the simplest of calculators that cost you 50 pence in a shop or something like that is immensely complex. and people never give it a second thought. So if you think the complexity seemed unbelievable back in 1977, what sort of complexity do modern chips have? I don't know what the transistor count is for a modern type chip, but it must be vast, vast. Now, the whole premise of the documentary was saying that these chips are coming, and they're going to have massive implications for society. They were talking about the fact that the Swiss clock industry, they laughed when the digital watch came into existence, and how it would never replace a properly precision manufactured timepiece. But of course, they a few years later, they were just a shadow of their own former self. So many employees lost their job, and I think I remember hearing somewhere that I think I saw on The Secret Life of Machines, they showed that the most advanced mechanical watch in the world, they had it on show, and they were showing that typically it's 10 times less reliable, so 10 times less accurate, I should say, than a cheap digital watch, because they showed that they compared it using a meter to compare the accuracies. That's and of course it's you're talking 50 pence for the watch, something like that. So it's quite astonishing, really. And then they're talking about the cash registers, the cash register industry, that was massive and happening down the pan. They're talking about automated warehouses, and they showed a fully automated warehouse loading. It was actually Persil washing powder, into among other things, into this automated warehouse. I think you find most warehouses are stocked that way nowadays. I mean, I don't know for definite, but I'd imagine it is. What would happen if let's say, satellites were knocked out through an electromagnetic storm, or something took the internet by mistake, something happened? How would you unload these things from the warehouse? People wouldn't know where anything is or how to do anything if the computer infrastructure collapsed or whatever, And they're talking about tills. They're showing a till that it didn't just it just wasn't just a standard till. It could actually transfer money from your bank account to the company's bank account, and they showed them using a card. But it was so early, they didn't have a card reader as such. You put the card in, I think the operator punched in the numbers, but it contacted the banks and transferred the money, which of course back then must have seemed like magic. And but they seen it had a more sinister side, because all the till operators, it recorded how fast they worked, and on top of that, how many mistakes they made. And I'm sure all these tills do that sort of thing now. They're also talking about automated self-driving tractors that would plough the field automatically. Now, I don't know if these things actually came into existence, but I do know a farmer friend of mine told me that his tractors use GPS locating, and they know in the field where the crops haven't done so well, so the tractor puts down more feed, and likewise where the crops are really good, it puts down less feed. So all kind of computer controlled, with minimal input from the operator. And if you think a few years back, not that long ago, there was hundreds of people working in the fields, but nowadays you only need one or two farm workers, and they can work the whole plot. They also showed an expert system where they had a senior doctor who'd spent a number of years trying to capture his expertise knowledge, him and a series of other experts capturing their expertise, so that junior doctors could do the rounds and had all the expertise of the senior doctor, and in fact could come up with a more accurate prognosis and quicker than in fact the senior doctor could, in fact. So it was actually a better service. I don't know how routinely that's used just now. Remember, all this was a prediction in 1977. They also mentioned about a new device called the word processor, and they marvelled at how sections of a document could be called up at the click of a button. and that how sections, so that I suppose if you had like legal documents, you could pull them together very quickly, with template paragraphs and such like. And they said that the biggest delay in creating documents typing was fixing errors, and they reckon that a word processor could replace certain typists. When's the last time you saw a typist these days? And at the end of the program, they had a panel of three experts, and they were asking implications about what they thought it would hold for society. Will they were asking questions such as, will there be greater unemployment? Will we have a divided, hollowed-out society between the elites and everyone else, with no middle class? A man on the panel suggested that Britain was already years behind, and stated that America and Germany, for example, helped their companies transition to the new digital age. They gave examples of like the mechanical cash register companies, and they gave them money to become digital, you know. I guess ultimately that still, I'm sure still these companies were still affected and hurt to some extent in America and Germany, but we just had to all go, of course. But the reason I just thought it was fascinating because so much of what they predicted seems to have come true, you know. And they keep saying that, you know, we shouldn't worry about technology, we should embrace it. It seems to me that you end up with more and more with fewer and fewer people working harder and harder to serve the elites at the top, and it seems to me that the difference between the rich and the poor is massively greater than at any other time, and getting worse, you know, as we progress. But just to say where that this is kind of led to is kind of related to the item which I just purchased recently. Now, the reason I bought this new piece of equipment is because, as the title of the documentary was called, the chips are down in price. All will be revealed shortly. I am an amateur radio operator. And my call sign is GM4MRX. No, I'm only joking. It's not GM4MRX. I'm not going to tell you what my call sign is because I'm Mr. X. But I am an amateur radio operator, and one of the amateur bands that I can transmit on is a 2 meter band. That's, you know, I think it's 144 megahertz to 146 megahertz. And I had a handset, a portable handset, a standard handset, which I'll just go and get. Hold on a second, I forgot to bring it through. All right. Okay. Okay. It's okay. Sorry about all that noise. So it's a standard C510A amateur handset, dual band, and oh, I don't know how old it is. It's quite a few years old. But at the time, it was a real bargain, and it was a friend of mine bought one and said, "Oh, you've got to get one of these standard handsets. They're fantastic, great value, incredible." And then amateur equipment tends to be very expensive, or used to be, still is to some extent. And so he got a standard C510E, which is the European version. This is an American version. The difference being that the repeater offsets are different. So on 70 centimeters, so I've got that's the 430 megahertz band, and so These have to be set manually. It's a bit more fiddly, but it can still be done. But it was all that was available at the time, because I was a bit slow at getting buying the radio. When I got there, all the other European ones were gone. But I've still got the standard C510A handset, and I think it cost £120, something like that. So £120, maybe say 10 years ago. I don't know when I bought this thing. But £120, and I thought that was a bargain. I really thought that's a great deal. Now, in recent years, I haven't used my amateur radio equipment very much, but I don't have so much time as I used to have these days, and I'm not at the computer very much these days either. So of course, there's an excuse. If I can manage to squeeze time into the record show, so can you. But anyway, I digress. So that was that. And I thought to myself, oh, it'd be quite nice when I'm out and about, if I took my handset with me, I could use it. But I thought, it's such a nice wee handset. I really like it. I don't want it to get damaged. And it kind of put me off. And I thought, I wonder how much handsets cost these days. So I had a wee look on eBay. I think it was eBay. And I was absolutely flabbergasted to see that there was a radio. I'm going to pronounce this wrong, and I do apologise to the, but it's I think it's B A. It's called it's spelled B A O, F E N G, F E N G. That's it. Bofeng. I don't know. Anyway, it's a Bofeng UV5R, and this radio was unbelievably £20. 20 UK pounds, I don't know what that is in dollars, but pretty damn cheap. So from £120 10 years or so ago to £20 today. And when I first saw it, I thought, that'd be rubbish, you know. And in fact, I was talking to an amateur using my handset and mentioned the Bofeng thing, and I said, oh yeah, I saw those, but I thought they were awfully cheap, it can't be much good. And of course the amateur was saying, oh yeah, well actually, that's what I've got. He said rather indignantly, and it's great, nothing wrong with it. Oh, all right, sorry. So I looked at some of the reviews and found they got pretty good reviews really, so I went ahead and purchased one. And it's the quality is unbelievable. It's really solid. It's a little bit more basic in some respects compared to the standard. My standard's got quite advanced memory channel options and such like, which the Bofeng doesn't have. But and the Bofeng really is designed for commercial use. It's kind of pressed into amateur use. It can be used by taxi firms, I guess, and marine, for marine use, shipped to shore or whatever. but because of the band of frequencies that it can receive and transmit on, it can also be used on amateur, both on 2 meter band, which is, as I've told you, said before, is 144 to 146, and 70 centimeters, around 430 megahertz. And so it's not fully duplex. It's just semi-duplex, so you can only transmit and receive on one frequency at a time. But my standard one is the same, of course. But it's just absolutely, I still can't get my head around £20. Unbelievable. And it comes with a lithium-ion battery, and it can be dropped into a docking charger, like a proper professional handset. Likewise, you can have a battery charging on its own whilst you're using the radio, if you've got a spare battery. And it came with a covert microphone and earpiece, which is great. All this for £20, just mind-blowing. They could make it for so little money. you look at the complexity, it's just astonishing. So, and of course the best thing of all is when you turn it on, it speaks to you. Channel mode, that's it, if you couldn't understand it.
Frequency mode.
frequency mode. Yeah, frequency mode. Fantastic. Really, really good. Unbelievable. So, let's see. When you look at the, let's see, what do the menus have? So it's got 40 menus on the thing. So you can adjust the squelch level, you can adjust the steps between each frequency when you're changing the channel, adjust the transmit power, you've got battery save function, which adjusts. What happens is the receiver goes into sleep mode every so many seconds if it's just sitting monitoring a frequency, and by that way it saves battery power. So it'll, and by the way, the battery performance is just unbelievable. It goes for hours and hours and hours, way longer than the standard handset I've got. Vox, voice operated control. So if you turn that on, you can just hold the microphone up to your mouth, and when it senses above a certain volume, it keys a transmitter, and then when you stop after so many seconds, it releases the transmitter, so you don't need to push any buttons. You've got a wide band and narrow band setting, which changes how wide the FM deviation is when you speak into the handset. Display illumination time, so that's how long the display stays on when you play with the radio. Dual watch allows you to monitor two frequencies simultaneously, so it'll switch between two frequencies. Key beep, so whether it beeps when you hit a key or not, or transmit timeout. So allows you to if you transmit too long, it'll time out. Now it saves the batteries. If you're going through an amateur repeater station, then if you transmit for too long, then the repeater at the other end might drop your signal because you're spending too long on the one channel, and then other people can't get a chance to use the repeater. So plus also, I think if you're on high power on this thing, it tends to get very hot, and maybe it also protects the output transistors on the radio. DCS, that's digital code squelch, that's a kind of filtering system. CTCSS, another kind of continuous tone carrier signal, is that what it stands for? I can't remember. It's another filtering system. DCS transmit, that sets the codes that you transmit for the filtering system. CTCS transmit, again, that's for your filtering. Voice prompt, I don't know what you got, I guess, I think you have got off on English and Chinese or something like that. 15 automated numbering ID, I don't know what that is. 16 DTMF tones when you transmit. 17 S code, signal code, God knows what the hell that is. 18 scanner resume method. So you've got different ways of, when you're scanning, when your radio is scanning, I'll let you hear scanning.
Scanning begin.
Yeah, scanning begin. I'll just stop that.
Scanning stop.
Scanning's. Oh, turn that down. Scanning stop. So when you're scanning the frequencies, you can set it so that when it comes across a signal, it pauses for so long and then continues. That's one type of one option. The other option is carrier. So it stops when it comes to a signal, but when the signal stops, it resumes scanning again. And there's a third option, which is called the search option. And so when it finds a signal, the scanning stops and it stays on that frequency. So that's three options. Very handy. I don't know if my standard's got all these options for scanning resume. When to send PTT ID. Beginning, end, or both. That's 1920s. Signal code, ending delay. 21 is channel mode A display. 22 channel mode B display. It's got two dual displays, although and it makes it look like it's a radio that can receive two frequencies simultaneously or transmit. But as I said before, it can't. I guess it's just a convenient way of switching between two set frequencies quickly, you know, budget channel lockout. So what that does is if the radio is receiving a signal, it won't allow you to transmit. Quite handy, stops you transmitting over the top of somebody. Automatic keypad lock, very handy. Frequency shift direction, that's so that the frequency changes when you hit, when you key the transmitter. And that's generally used for working through repeater stations. The actual frequency shift you want to shift when you transmit. So for example, here in the UK, when you go through a 2 meter repeater station, it drops the transmit frequency by 600 kilohertz. So for example, if you're transmitting on say 145600, so if you're listening on 145600, when you push the transmit button, it drops to 145000. And then the repeater listens on 145000 and it retransmits back out on 145600, so other stations can hear your broadcast. That's essentially how a repeater works. And of course that'll be up high in a hill, so it's got a large range, and obviously more power than a handset would have. 27, store a memory channel. 28, delete a memory channel, that's self-evident. 29, display backlight, standby. 30, display backlight, receive. 31, display backlight, transmit. And you've got three colours, but is it kind of purpley, bluey and green, something like that. I can't remember, but it's quite funky the way it switches between all the different colours. Alarm mode. Now there's a red button, an orange button on the side, and if you hold it, it does something. It sends some sort of signal on a preset frequency. So I guess the idea is if you were a security guard and you were being attacked, you could hit this orange button, and it would send off a signal to whoever was listening. Being that I'm an amateur, there's not much point in that. Another curious thing it's got is it's got a light on the top of it. So if you touch a button, this LED comes on. I guess if you wander around a building site or something like that was dark, you could pop the light on to see where you were going. Or it's actually very, very handy. And it's also got a built-in radio. So if you're a bored security guard, you hit this button and it jumps to the radio. I'll just turn that on the now. Right, so if I hit this, what button is it now? Is it that one? No, it's this one. No, it's not that. So that's the radio. And when a signal appears on the say 2 meters or whatever, it'll jump off the radio. And then once that goes away, it'll jump back to the radio again, so you don't miss any broadcasts. So, I mean, for a bored security guard, that would be fantastic, I'd imagine. It's quite handy as well, too, even for an amateur. You've got band selection, so that it's got two bands, a VHF band and a UHF band. So VHF band, I think it's something like 136 megahertz to 170 odd, something like that. And the UHF, I'm not sure what that is. I don't have the manual to hand, but 34, transmit selection dual watch mode. Not sure what that is. 35, squelch tail elimination. Now these ones are to do with working through a repeater and to try and minimise noises as you're switching through the repeater, basically, like hissing and crackling when you release the button. Squelch tail elimination, squelch tail elimination through repeater, delay the squelch tail off repeater. So these are 35, 36 and 37. Generally I just turn all these off. Power on message. So I've got mine such that when I turn it on, it displays my call sign. So if my radio was found, somebody could return it to me if they chose to do so. 39, Roger beep. So that's a bit kind of frowned upon in an amateur world, but if you wanted to do that, particularly if you're a security guard or whatever, it could be handy. And 40, reset to default. So that just resets things. So loads and loads of options on the thing, as you can see. Now, when I was looking at the radio, I came across, I was looking at the manufacturer's manual, and it's obviously a Chinese manual, so it's not perfect, but it really isn't bad. It's quite understandable and quite straightforward, but I was looking through the manual, and I looked at it again later on. And when I was looking at it, I was reading this piece, and it was I can't remember what it was. It's something like, oh, I the reader might say it's got a 7-character display, but you can actually only do six. And there's function there's icons on the display that don't seem to be active on this reader. And I'm thinking, that's a strange phrase for the manufacturers to say. And when I looked a bit further at it, I discovered I hadn't opened the same file as I did before. This one wasn't the manufacturer's manual. This was a completely different manual. It was part of the Chinese radio documentation project. And the fact, the reason I was, I mean, the quality is just superb. And there's lots of extra information that the original manufacturer didn't put in. But the reason I got to, that I didn't realize was that it's got these elaborate line drawings that show in great detail the layout of the radio and all its buttons and switches and knobs and such like. But it was such great detail that I never thought for a minute that it was anything other than a manufacturer. And it turns out that the pictures were drawn on Inkscape, of all things. And so the Chinese Radio Documentation Project is an open source project, and that this manual was written by, now I'm going to murder this name, Leonard Lidberg, Lennart, and it's Liderg. So well done, Leonard. It was very, very good manual. Very impressed. So God, just incredible. So another nice thing about this radio is that you can hook it up to a computer, and just send settings and memories and whatnot from your computer into the radio, and you can also clone one handset onto another handset. So that's quite nice. And of course, it came with a wee disc. No, it didn't come with a wee disc. I bought the interface cable separately, and it came with a wee disc. And of course, all the software runs on Windows. And I came across this program called Chirp, Chirp. And Chirp is also an open source project. And Chirp allows you to upload and download settings, frequencies, and memory channels to a wide selection of radios. Chirp is available for, I think, Linux, Windows, and, well, it's definitely Linux, Windows, and I think Apple. Chirp's a very active project with constant updates to support more radios and bug fixes. A repository is available for Ubuntu users. The site warns that users may experience difficulty getting cheap Chinese data cables to work, and that counterfeit chips are detected in Windows. I don't know about Apple, and so they generally don't work. Linux, however, ignores this and should work no problem. And they say that if this is all too much hassle for people, they've also got a live distro set up, just ready to go for users who can't be bothered. So it's just incredible. So I installed the, I put the repo, added it to my Ubuntu computer, and installed Chirp, and which give, I think, daily updates to the software. And the chances are that Chirp will actually be better than the software that comes with the radio for a number of reasons. I didn't try the Windows software. So some of the benefits are that it allows you to transfer memories from one manufacturer radio to another. This would almost certainly not be available from the manufacturer software. On my particular radio, it allowed me to set settings outside the range given on the radio's menu. So, for example, I could set the backlight timer to 25 seconds. I think the highest you could set it in the menu was 10 seconds. I could also play around with the squelch range to make it a bit heavier squelch than the defaults that were there. So just a fantastic piece of software. It also allows you to the sources where you can pull in frequencies, a lot of stuff for America, and one or two things for the UK. So you just pick the menu option and these frequencies all appear, which you can then just drop in onto your screen and then upload it to your radio. So it's just a lovely bit of software, very, very good. And I never had any problems getting the interface cable to work. You do have to make sure you push it all the way in, and it can be a wee bit stiff sometimes going in, but no, on the whole, really, really good. And just unbelievably over the moon with it. You know, it's a £20 radio. It feels like £100 radio plus. We're just going to end in another 10 years. Will these radios cost a fiver? I don't know. Or a pound? I don't know. But anyway, I hope I haven't bored you too much. I thought, I don't know how many of you are amateur radio operators out there, but I thought even for people who have got a little interest in radio might like to hear this episode. And I hope I haven't stuttered and ummed and awed too much. Actually, it was all off the cuff. So I think that's about it for this episode. I hope you enjoyed it. And I can... Oh, so before I go, just to let you know, I can be contacted at Mr. X, that's MRX, at, that's AT, HPR, the at symbol, googlemail.com. Mr. X at HPR at googlemail.com. So until next time, thank you and goodbye.
You've been listening to Hacker Public Radio at hackerpublicradio.org. We are a community podcast network that releases shows every weekday, Monday through Friday. Today's show, like all our shows, was contributed by an HPR listener like yourself. If you ever thought of recording a podcast, then click on our contribute link to find out how easy it really is. Hacker Public Radio was founded by the Digital Dog Pound and the Infonomicon Computer Club, and is part of the Binary Revolution at binrev.com. If you have comments on today's show, please email the host directly, leave a comment on the website, or record a follow-up episode yourself. Unless otherwise stated, today's show is released under a Creative Commons Attribution ShareAlike 3.0 license.